Okay, so this is the DJMblog.com podcast 3, recorded on the December 12th, 2010. So we can start when we really want. I can chop it up, but
okay.
All right, so welcome, Jessica.
Hi, everybody.
Welcome, Jim.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, now we're hoping that we get you at different levels right here, but we have you going in through FaceTime, and now we're recording in the GarageBand, so we're hoping that we get everybody's audible on it. So Jessica, like, you want to talk about, like, you did some really interesting writing at jessica.sf3am.com on yoga recently.
Yes, I've been doing yoga every day for 30 days in December, except for when I'm away for Christmas. And it's been a really interesting experience, and it's been hard to write every day and make that commitment to write every day, but it's been good practice, and I've been a little backlogged, so I just released, like, I think 6 blog posts today. So I'm going to get better at writing more every day, including tweets. I think it'd be fun to just write something once every day.
Yeah, you're a good writer too. So if you have time to do that, you should do that.
Yeah.
So what's the iPhone? Our thing is we always talk about iPhone applications on this podcast.
We do. I've been using Foursquare a lot. I feel like if I get in on the ground, you know, I will be rewarded later. But I don't know.
Yeah. Is it Jim? Have you seen much about Foursquare?
Most of what I've seen is actually Jessica showing me, which leads me to think that somehow my age group is kind of missing the point of it, because none of my friends actually use it. I know it's been, you know, it's a social thing that's been gathering some steam lately, and I think it's an interesting idea. I think if they could just somehow reach, you know, the people that I associate with a little better, that, you know, they could have something really good on their hands. Because my age group, 23, 24-ish, we don't tend to, like, even think of that very much.
Yeah, and you have a few friends that are on it. So it's one of those classic network effect things. That really depends on whether people use it.
Yeah, I think the game aspect is fun, where you can, like, unlock badges, but I wonder if that's a really interesting concept, if it's not speaking to you to, like, you know, get a free bar appetizer after your third chicken. Like, do you want people to know where you are, other people to know where you are? Like, do your friends use Facebook places?
I don't actually use Facebook.
Yeah, so. Jim's one of the cool people who isn't a Facebook user. Very admirable, actually.
Yeah.
I actually, you know, the story behind that, of course, is when I was in college and I signed up for a Facebook account in 2004, 2005, it was a, for colleges only, you had to have an academic email address in order to authenticate and create an account. It was something specifically for college students, and I remember my hip cousin, Cleet, asking me if I was on Facebook, and I had no idea what it was. This was like 2003, 2004, and he's like, man, when you get to college, don't worry, you're going to be on Facebook. No, there's no way to avoid it. And sure enough, you know, in the weeks before I went off to college, everyone from my high school was signing up for Facebook, and from their, you know, in their own universities or whatever.
Yeah.
And back then, of course, you could view people's profiles if they were in the same network as you, and the network would be your school.
Right.
So it was more about a local connections. The people on your Facebook friends list were people living down your hall.
Yeah.
And nowadays, it seems to me like it's a modern incarnation of MySpace, which of course still has a niche. It's more of a music kind of thing these days.
It's all it really has anymore. Everything else is taken off, but bands, I guess, occasionally still promote their MySpace site.
It's like the Walmart of the internet. You know, you can get all your information.
Wait, what is?
Facebook.
Okay.
You know, like, it's your one-stop shopping. You get photos, you get some articles, you see what your friends are up to, you can pine over people or stalk people, you know, like...
It's not giving you the premium brand of everything. It's not like the top, you know, photo sharing site. It's I guess in terms of volume it is, but in terms of like quality and archiving,
it's only as good as your network. So like I have a couple people that share really interesting stuff, but I probably could just follow them on Twitter, because a lot of the stuff on Facebook, I'm like, I don't care. Who cares? I'm over it, but I'm on it still for work.
And a lot of people that we know are just updating Facebook. They're not updating Twitter, right? You can push from Twitter to Facebook more easily than push out from Facebook. It's that walled garden situation. In terms of more iOS apps, you know what? I really love the Hipstamatic camera. I've been like using that. And it was a hit at the bar when we were out with some friends. Everybody thought it was kind of cool, huh? No, it was fun. It's a cool camera. It's based on some obscure 1980s film camera, but it uses virtual lenses and virtual films and different kinds of flashes. It creates different effects. It's pretty cool.
I think photography is magical, and I am so impressed with its evolution. Like, the fact that it has totally transformed onto the digital space, down to the iPhone camera, all the different techniques that you can do that used to take a lot of time in the dark room or having a special camera, now you can just take it with your iPhone. Like, it's just, it's amazing how you can still explore all those old styles of photography.
Yeah, it's definitely become a big trend. And I wanted to mention also there's Retro Camera Plus, which is sort of similar to Hipstamatic, but it's free. So that's a cool one to try out. It has five different cameras, and you just change the actual camera. You don't interchange virtual lenses and things like that with different virtual films. It just has one way that each of the five do it. But it's pretty neat, and it's free. So I'd recommend that to people, too. And there's a lot of great apps. I mean, I'm sure it'll probably come up again. But I also Fruit Ninja. I just wanted to mention my picks. I really like Fruit Ninja. Jim told us about that.
Kudos to Jim for that. So addictive.
Yeah, I do have all. Last time I checked on Game Center, I have the highest scores out of all my friends on. Basically all the games I have, but Fruit Ninja being the one that I have in common with most. Of my Game Center friends, and I'm up to about 426 in the arcade mode, which is it's interesting because you need a certain, you know, element of luck to come your way, because you have to get these special bananas that either slow down the screen or they create a frenzy where tons come to the on the screen at once, or other bonuses like that. And I find that sometimes that you just get the right combination of them and you just get a high score. Otherwise you're just kind of screwed. So it's kind of a fun game because it has an arbitrary kind of side to it, but then, you know, the other modes are cool, and especially the playing online against people. I think that's pretty fun.
I don't think I explained adequately. It's a game where you basically swipe across the screen and just destroy fruit, right? And you just blow up the fruit and you get...
Avoid bombs, destroy the fruit.
Yeah, and you don't even really destroy it. You slice it in half quite nicely.
Yeah, because you're a ninja. You're not making a mess.
You know, it's
you're
not
doing
like,
very precisely.
You know, it's very...
another game, I'm not sure if I've seen you on the boards there. I don't know if you play this one, Jim, but I like Cut the Rope. Jessica mentioned that one to me. She was playing the light version. It's really fun. I don't know why, but I've really gotten into that game in the last few days. It's just a game.
I believe that I am on the boards for that, because I went through pretty meticulously and got the full 3 stars on about the first 60 levels that I just kept on going until I got the highest amount of stars possible before I go on to the next level. And then they recently came out with an update and they added like 20 more levels or something.
That was really neat. They added like a Christmas like series, like of levels or something. Wasn't it like a Christmas related? And I don't know.
It might have been. I haven't actually gotten around to playing it very recently. I know Angry Birds changed their Halloween app to just a general holiday app. And so now all the Halloween levels that were there are there, but the front interface is Christmas right now.
And that's
that
a cool
was,
game, yeah,
that
and
was
it's neat.
Free with
yeah,
the upgrade?
They did Cut the Rope, added another set of levels, and Angry Birds Halloween added Angry Birds Christmas. Basically, those were both free updates with when you had the app. So and if you had the app, your update it was just in the update, and if you buy it now, new now, it has that in it. So I think that is kind of neat. These games that are like, I think Cut the Rope's $1. I think the Angry Birds Seasons, as they call it now, instead of Angry Birds Halloween, that one is $1. So it's definitely a really cool game, and everybody's talking about Angry Birds now. There's a big, it's a big thing. But Cut the Rope, I just, because in case people are trying to picture how it works, I summed it up as this game involves moving a candy ball that follows inverted gravity into a hungry frog-like creature's mouth, mainly by cutting ropes and also popping bubbles while picking up stars. And I just
thought it's just a physics kind of thing. You just try to imagine that it's something real in front of you swinging, and it's pretty intuitive. I like it because it does kind of feel natural, and the rhythm that you have in cutting these ropes and letting it go on to other things. It gets you through these levels, and in the process, picking up some stars. If you just beat it without getting any stars, you can go on to the next level, but you don't get as high of a score. But,
yeah,
you're not going to be the talk of the game center town.
Yeah. The ebook readers was something I was going to mention because I've been poking around with those. You can get them for free. You can get the iBooks one for free. The Kindle. I don't know if that maybe that just comes with your iPhone now. Amazon Kindle, Barnes & Noble, Nook, and then Google Books. And I haven't really tried the Kindle app, but I tried the Nook app, the Google Books app, and the iBooks app. And I would say I really like the Nook app, and I like the iBooks app too. Uh-huh. The Google Books one I think is sort of beta, like a lot of Google stuff. Have any of you guys tried any of those different ones? Jim, you've tried iBooks and stuff.
I've used iBooks, and I've seen the Amazon Kindle app in action, which seems perfectly fine. I think most of these e-reader apps will probably be similar in functionality to the other one. It's more about the content. It might be more convenient to people who have a Kindle, obviously, to get the Kindle app and be able to get all the stuff they already bought on their phone or on their Kindle. Otherwise, if you're not sure if you're going to stay on one platform or another in the next couple years, if you get your library on the Kindle library, you can basically take it to whatever platform you want.
Yeah.
Same with Barnes & Noble, Nook, and Google Books. The only thing holding iBooks back is, which isn't much of a holdback, is that people are pretty much stuck on that platform for the books they've bought. But the way Apple's going these days, that's probably not much of an inhibition to people. They're probably not worried about whether or not they'll be able to get to it later.
I was gonna say I've never read any a novel on a digital format before.
Yeah, we don't have any tablets or Kindles here, so I've actually found though that the iPhone 4 with the iBooks or with the Nook app, you can just you can really read pretty well on it. It's nice,
Especially with the Retina display, it helps to just have a great resolution. The text looks crisp, and it's easy to read. I saw a book, side by side on a iPhone 3G and an iPhone 4, and it was a lot easier on the eyes, I thought, to look at it on the 4.
Yeah.
It seems like a little less effort with reading.
For sure. You know what I want to do is I want to offer a little interlude to our listeners. It's a pretty good track that we've got here.
Never added the extra bass,
though. Yeah, it's still a work in progress.
He called it Nasty LA Beats with a Z.
Yeah. Have you thought of a good rhyme to put on to top of this, Jessica?
No, I have not. But I will.
Upstairs.
Your room?
Yeah. No, actually, you know, Dan's old room, actually.
Where's that chair from?
Oh, that's a recent addition.
Yeah.
It sits facing a TV I set up in here. You know, my dad's been recovering from knee surgery, so he spends a lot of time in the lazy boy in the living room, and to kind of give him his space and not make him watch South Park with me. You know, I moved the TV into a different room, and I've been kind of, you know, when I play video games or watch TV, I usually do it up here. So
you pulled that. Where's that recliner from, though?
Someone was getting rid of it, one of my mom's friends, and they offered it to me, and I was like, sure, it's pretty comfortable. It has a matching footrest, too, but, it's not in the room here. It would be a little tight in here with the big bed, too.
That's awesome.
Cool. Yeah, awesome. Well, I don't know, I mean, I wanted to mention, I don't know if it was even worth really mentioning, but I went to Guitar Center. And I got some new picks, so I was really excited to talk about those. I got Fender Thin, I got some of my celluloid, some of my old ones, and then I tried these Oltex 0.6 millimeters. Have you ever tried those Oltex ones, Jim?
I haven't. I've been mostly a Fender man, except in the past couple years I've used Dunlop.
Yeah.
The Dunlop mediums, the orange ones, those are my favorite.
I really like those, and I have those Dunlop Tortex ones, but I just decided, I think Oltex is another brand by Dunlop, not sure, but they're a real interesting feel. They got a kind of a quick snap to them. They're not as smooth as those Tortex ones, but they have an interesting kind of attack to them. They're a little, glassy, I don't know. You tried them, Jessica.
Yeah, they felt pretty similar to me.
Yeah, they're all guitar picks. All right. Well, so...
But I saw the subtle difference.
Yeah, oh, sure.
It's a drastic difference.
No, it's not, because all the ones I have are relatively thin. They're all, like, 0.5 millimeter or 0.6 or something. Like, it's a very... You know, I tend to go for the thinner picks for what I, the way I play. I don't know.
Well, I'll need a pick when I play my acoustic guitar, right?
Yeah, I'm all about you playing the acoustic guitar if you want to commit to that.
We're going to steal the amp from Joey.
That's right there. He can. I think it's actually, right here. He's looking at it, right? The Fender amp, which is actually ours, so I don't think that's really theft.
Oh, it just sounds more dramatic.
It does. Has anybody been following the WikiLeaks revelations? There's been a whole, like, river of them.
Keeps coming out, yeah.
I personally downloaded the 256-bit encrypted AES, file that they put out as an insurance policy, where, it's basically military-grade encryption. It's a huge file. I think it's those cables. They have tons and tons and tons of those diplomatic cables, and they've released, just a tiny little fraction of them.
Yeah.
And so it's either the rest of those or maybe some more stuff or whatever, but Julian Assange has called it, I forget exactly how he phrased it. Something with nuclear, something very dramatic, So if he gets pulled up on trumped up crap, which seems like is most likely the case with that warrant from Sweden, he can just, there's a certain amount of people in WikiLeaks who know that password for the file. And unless you have this password, you're not going to, read the information in this file. It's military grade encryption. Maybe someone in China has cracked it already. In fact, maybe probably the Chinese are probably reading all of them right now and like laughing. Whatever goes down, he can just give a password. And then, this file has been, shared through torrents and that kind of stuff to hundreds of thousands, if not millions of computers around the world. So there's basically no way they could snuff it out or silence it. All they have to do is give the password.
Yeah. And,
a huge barrage of information, completely unredacted, which in case people are wondering out there, a lot of this WikiLeaks stuff that you hear hearing about how, supposedly they're putting all these people in danger and stuff. The Afghan and Iraq war logs don't actually have names in them. A lot of the locations have actually been redacted. I went through a bunch of them, you know, when those started coming out, they put them up on the web, and I started, you know, going through them to see if I can really find anything interesting, and I found that it was actually kind of hard, because some of the stuff was so vague, and it was so heavily redacted, you know? I think that the harm that's come to people has been greatly overstated by the U.S. And a very unsurprising totalitarian response to what's going on. And that's a whole nother point. You know, it really doesn't matter who's in the White House these days. You know, the U.S. is as totalitarian as you can possibly get about this kind of stuff in a society that calls itself free. So I did financially support WikiLeaks before PayPal froze their account. I'm glad those assets got freed up, because I'm pretty sure 20 or 30 bucks of mine were in the $41,000 that were frozen and from the Julian Assange defense fund. But PayPal recently released the funds but said you still can't use this account. So I'm glad they conceded a little bit there. But, you know, it's just amazing. I just the same old characters. Joel Lieberman, you know.
Yeah, that ridiculous threat against the New York Times that he made.
Yeah, and then you know, he put a lot of pressure on Amazon to get WikiLeaks off its servers. And, you know, he I don't know, a year or two back, he was on a television show talking about how, you know, China has a switch they can throw that, like, turns off the internet.
Yeah.
And we need like that. We need something like that in America. So this Joel Lieberman. I mean, if I ever see that guy in the street, I don't know how I would resist the urge to just, like, pee on him or something.
He's a deeply illiberal fellow. So
anyway, I guess it's pretty obvious. I'm a supporter of WikiLeaks and what they do. I'm glad that I supported them financially before it became very difficult to do so, and. I hope that, you know, things keep on going for them. And I think the response from people in the world on the internet has been pretty great. All the mirrors of the site now that are up, there's over 500 websites that are hosting all the content of WikiLeaks. So, you know, the international hacker community has basically stepped up and said, hey, there's no way you're going to stop us from getting this information out.
Yeah,
you better start reconsidering your policy, and that's what the end game is. Obviously,
they have the hackers out there setting up websites and mirroring everything, downloading those that backup file, that insurance file, or whatever that thing is called, and then there's also like the crackers and the script kiddies that are going to town on MasterCard and PayPal. And I've heard that's really disrupted a lot of commerce. The results are coming in, and
yeah,
a lot of sites
are losing
donations
without compromising anyone's information. I don't think anybody's Visa like information got hacked.
Yeah, I don't think that was the point.
It's been hard to process payments from the denial of service attack, which was the point. Yeah,
for sure. You know, another crazy story. I mean, there are so many things that are coming out about the WikiLeaks, and a lot of this stuff is stuff that people know or suspected, but it's moving into the light of day. But like all the stuff about how many all the different nasty things people say about each other, how Angela Merkel pretended like she was serious about it in a warrant of issued in Germany for CIA officers, but she privately admitted that she wasn't serious about it. All these different dossiers on foreign leaders, all the people, talking about, just Hugo Chavez, all these crazy, just back channel things that are coming out. But again, it's a lot of the kind of stuff that's not fundamentally surprising, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what is the biggest, there's that really good Guardian page that I like there's a link to in the show notes. They go day by day and they say stuff like, U.S. diplomats are concerned about the growing power of Russian organized crime, believe it has contact with the highest levels of government in Moscow. Like, everybody knows the Russian mob is a pretty big deal, especially if you lived in the Richmond neighborhood of San Francisco. But I mean, you know, there's a lot of this, you know, a lot of this stuff is pretty embarrassing, I guess, for the people in power. But yeah, again, this, no one's saying even that this, like you're saying about all that rhetoric about how this is harming people. It really isn't. It's embarrassing, powerful, famous people, and rich people. You know, the whole thing, Saudi Arabia is the world's largest source of funds for Islamist militant groups, and the Saudi government is reluctant to stem the flow of money, according to Hillary Clinton. So that's another thing, is that this stuff is very recent, and it's like, this is the kind of thing that's very dangerous diplomatically to be coming out, about this stuff. I don't know. What do you know?
Yeah, you know, I think the people who feel endangered or are endangered by this are the only the powers that be, you know, and it's not the they talk about, you know, these war logs and stuff being like, you know, blueprints for terrorist attacks, or the diplomatic cables are going to expose things that we, you know, put a lot of resources into, and they say they're going to create, you know, basically blueprints for terrorist attacks or whatever. But I think, and I don't agree with a lot of what Ron Paul says, but Ron Paul made some pretty good points the other day about, you know, the danger here is that we're occupying the Middle East, and it's not stemming from these leaks. The danger and the reason that these people are being radicalized and they hate us is because we're occupying them. It's retarded. It's ridiculous. It's pretty obvious at this point. You know, we've been playing this game for 9 years. This whole like war with the Middle East in the post 2000 era. It's not going well. It's our generation's Vietnam, all this stuff. And it's really a tragedy that the country fell into the trap of the preemptive war. You know, that's what all, of course, maybe not preemptive war in Afghanistan, but Iraq, which, you know, if you, one way or another, did not help the situation. It did not make us any more capable of winning in Afghanistan. Which I don't know what winning in Afghanistan really means.
Yeah, it's a good question. What does that mean?
What would victory in Afghanistan mean? Would it mean like McDonald's?
You know what?
And it's not that type
yeah,
of place.
It's tribal, you know, it's country. Not. It's very backward. You know, I have this write up at guardian.co.uk, the warlog summaries. I'm looking at this one right here. The Afghan president, I'm quoting Hamid Karzai, is erratic, emotional, and prone to believing paranoid conspiracy theories, according to frustrated diplomats and foreign statesmen. He has also been accused by his own ministers of complicity in criminal activity. I mean, of course, his brother is the biggest drug dealer in the country, and he's protected by the CIA, and that's openly admitted now. I mean,
yeah, well, that's the problem. The corruption is just so rampant in government. So no one in Afghanistan wants to trust the government. And while people don't really feel, while a lot of people may not feel that the Taliban is good, people give him credit for being able to look at things objectively and govern on them. You know, there was one set of rules. Mm-hmm. People did get treated fairly uniformly. You know, it might have been bad, but it was the same all around. No one trusts the government that we've installed in Afghanistan,
no.
And there's no good reason to trust them either. So it's basically a pick your poison situation in Afghanistan, and I think. Definitely the government corruption has allowed this thing to just go on and on and on and on and on, because there's nothing really suitable to take the Taliban's place. And, well, they still take, you know, what do they control, 80% of the country right now? Geographically, anyway?
Supposedly central government doesn't control anything outside the capital, Kabul, effectively.
Yeah, so, I mean... Yeah, I mean, I don't want to sound un-American, but you know, we lost.
Yeah, for sure. Speaking of, I don't know if losers is the right word, but speaking of people that are having a tough time governing their own country, Barack Obama. There was this press conference just in the last few days. Barack Obama brought Bill Clinton in. Did you see this? He brought Bill Clinton in to defend his tax cut compromise that a lot of liberals are really mad about. And he said, "Well, I've had the first lady waiting for half an hour. I'm just going to turn it over to you, Bill," or something just exactly to that effect. And he walks out, and Bill Clinton is right there in front of the White House, you know, logo behind him in the White House briefing room, answering questions, joining with reporters. It absolutely bizarre stuff. Like, here he is, like,
"My advice, and whatever I say should become public only if he decides to make it public."
Yeah, so, you know, just the same kind of nonsense, but, you know, talking about, like, all the advice he gives Obama and all that. Like, I don't know. I mean, isn't there something weird going on with the president? I know this is a meme that's out there, and I don't know what the point of this. Maybe that's the thing I want to talk about, is not so much that he seems to be acting erratic, but that's the way a lot of things are being reported. And they're asking him about his smoking. They're really ribbing him about that. Like, he's losing a lot
apparently
of that kind of authority.
He hasn't had a cigarette in 9 months or something. I was reading that he was, you know, in the process of quitting, and that the press secretary guy said that recently that he hadn't seen Obama with a cigarette in 9 months or something like that.
Yeah, it's not like the actual facts. It's one thing, but it seems like the media is pushing this narrative that he's disengaging. And there he is saying he has to go to a Christmas party instead of be at the press conference. That it does seem kind of disengaged. But I mean, what do you think is? Does anybody have any theories about what's going on with the? Of course, we don't want to be like the Afghan president, I guess, and have conspiracy theories, you know. But do you have any theories about what's going on?
I don't have really a theory about what's going on per se. I just I know I was reading something recently that said that wealthy people tend to save tax cuts instead of spend them.
Yeah, invest and save, and if you give it to
not even invest, just save.
Well, invest in their own portfolio. Yeah, just holding cash, yeah. Maybe. Yeah, and if you give it to working people, they'll spend the money.
I mean, I guess since the Democrats aren't going to have Congress for you know, more than a week or two,
the House
anymore. Or the House, that, you know, I guess we just have to, like, already start doing whatever Republicans want or something. I don't understand.
It's a very strange kind of surrender that the administration seemed to do.
They surrendered well before the elections too. I mean,
yeah.
Think about healthcare and how we let the Republicans add. I don't know how many amendments to it. It was 150, 200 amendments to the healthcare bill. You know, we said we'll give you X, Y, and Z, you know, as a concession on our part. And then we did, there was all these Republican written amendments to the bill, and then not a single one casted a vote for it. So it's like,
yeah.
we had already given up before we even lost the election. So I don't know how they do it, but conservatives just tend to, like, when they get in power, they just tend to do better with it.
Well, they tend to try to use it to set their own agenda instead of talking about compromise from the very beginning. Like Obama kept saying at the very beginning of the healthcare debate, "I'm taking a totally single-payer system off the table." Like, why would you take that off the table? Republicans never take things off the table in order to show good faith in negotiation. They negotiate hard every time and try to push their thing, and they'll shut government down or do whatever they want to do, whatever they can do to get their agenda, right? And it's like Democrats, like, are taking things off the table. And I guess part of that is the corporate power over a lot of Democrats, and part of that is that, like, that whole blue dog thing that is largely going away now. So many of those so-called blue dogs, those conservative Democrats, lost or retired in the last election. So I guess at least the House will be more, you know, on the center left, where the Democrats naturally, you know, I guess would be. But Pelosi's staying in power. What do you think about that? Why not, huh? Is that cool? Nancy Pelosi? No one wants to let Steny Hoyer take over. What do you think of Nancy Pelosi staying in?
You know, I kind of like Nancy Pelosi. She's a she's feisty.
Yeah.
For her age,
and the move, you gotta love the move, not, even if you don't love her. Sorry.
Yeah, I fully agree. I like Nancy Pelosi. I think she was a great speaker, and that I definitely don't want to see her completely out of the picture, you know, come next term or whatever. So I'm happy that she'll be around in you know, a potent capacity. She did a pretty decent job.
Yeah, you know, one group of people I don't think did a decent job was Samsung in making the Galaxy Tab. We were at Best Buy looking at that not that long ago, and I know you've seen them. Like,
I wanted to show you how bad Flash worked on it because it's one of their selling points. And then because I had checked it out a couple days before at a Best Buy, and so I think we had swung by a Best Buy. And I wanted to show you, check out how slow this runs, this Flash website. And it wouldn't even really load to the point where I thought it was bad before. On that particular instance, when I tried showing you, it wouldn't even work, period. And it became unresponsive and basically seemed like it was having, like, some kind of huge memory leak or something.
Yeah, like, something like that.
It just froze up on it. And,
yeah.
We were still able to admire the screen for its brightness and colors, which I have to say, the screens look nice on the Galaxy Tabs. I think that Samsung's Super AMOLED screens are really nice. If they could up the resolution a little bit, they'd have the best display on the market. But otherwise, I think they're pretty much one of the best out there. And that's basically the best thing that the Galaxy Tab has going for it. It seems underpowered. It seems like it's an Android phone with a giant...
Yeah, and it's not that big. That 7-inch size, I don't really know where that fits for someone like me now. Some people say they like that size, but I like the full tablet size, like the iPad or like the phone. iPhone 4 can do so much.
Yeah.
It seems kind of like a bridge not far enough to get that, to have a smaller tablet like that.
Is there a phone on it?
No, but there is a chip for telecom.
There might actually be a phone function. Those Android tabs are interesting like that. I think if you get one from Verizon or Sprint, you might be able to actually receive calls on it.
You could probably use Google Voice or something anyway on it, right? So you could
probably Google Voice doesn't provide VoIP.
Oh, all right, well, Skype or one of those applications.
Or I guess maybe you could use, in essence, Google Voice by logging into the web or the desktop version of gmail.com. And you know how you can use the call widget now to make a VoIP call free on that? I suppose maybe that would work since Flash works, but you have to download a separate plugin for that, at least for my Mac, you know, so it's Flash isn't the only prerequisite for that widget. So I don't know what it has for VoIP. You can probably get a ton of apps that use the SIP protocol, or, you know, you can't use Skype on it, can you? You can only use that if you have Verizon Wireless or something.
They always have restrictions on Android like that. I don't know.
I wonder when the Flash battle is going to be over.
I think it is.
I
don't know if there's any, but we're going to see any more websites debut something using Flash, you know, like the next, I know there's some music websites like, I don't know if Beatport is like this, but a couple music websites I know deliver 100% of their content through a Flash base.
Oh yeah, Beatport, picking, checkout system, it's all encoded inside Flash, yeah, which is very dated now.
Yeah, I think if we saw a new website like that come out, or a startup and their site was in Flash, I would be amazed. You know, I don't think anybody starting a project around now, or even in the last year, I don't think they're starting it in Flash. I think people are going to hang on to Flash for existing projects. That would be too much work to retool in HTML5. And of course, there's a lot of web video that people aren't going to want to rewrap, you know, because, I mean, even most Flash video is just loading an MP4, you know, from a remote site in a Flash wrapper.
There's no reason
to be able to process it with your own hardware, but instead it's being done through that software layer. And that's what, so many of the performance problems happen on any platform, but especially mobile. It can be a huge resource hog. And I think more and more sites that are coming out with HTML5 layouts are just proving that, you know, it's still a hurdle, but it works, and it's not even a finalized standard. You know, HTML5 is not its final version, right? It's still a work in progress.
Draft spec, yeah.
Mm-hmm. A lot of adoption there. So, and I was reading that somewhere around 50% of the web videos available in HTML5 now, but I guess that's skewed by the fact that, like, you can basically watch any YouTube video in HTML5, and that's probably 40% of the web video, at least, in one place. So, I don't know. I think the battle's basically over, because it's the developers tell the tale, you know, and I don't think any new major development is going to be happening with Flash.
Well,
I think Adobe's also probably going to retool to generate things in HTML5 with their tools.
Yeah.
They might as well. I think that's probably going to be something they're going to do and probably be pretty good at, because they do make pretty much, I think, the best web software out there. You know, I use Dreamweaver and Photoshop and Illustrator a lot, and I don't really know of great equivalents to that. So I think Adobe, you know, they can probably do an HTML5 generating kind of application to replace Flash in the future.
Well, speaking of no Flash platforms, I guess they're starting to dribble out rumors. The rumors are starting to dribble out about the new iPad, and there are a lot of rumors that there's going to be cameras on both sides. That definitely excites me. I know it's kind of ridiculously large to just walk around with uses a camera, but I still think it's necessary. I think you still got to go there.
Why not? Yeah.
And then also maybe a higher res screen. Sorry.
The front facing camera is you're gonna need that on your
For the FaceTime, yeah.
Yeah, or in the Galaxy tabs have front-facing ones. More and more phones have it. It's just going to be a standard mobile, you know, gimmick, a front-facing camera. And then, yeah, if it has a nice camera facing the other way, that's great. Otherwise, really, I'm probably going to end up getting it either way, because I'm not going to base the decision to get it whether or not it has a front-facing. Or I mean, a rear-facing camera. Because holding an iPad up and taking pictures of people would probably be obnoxious for everyone.
Well, yeah. So if you're gonna get, I still think it could be a fun novelty, and people would still use it. It may look very bizarre. But what are you looking for yourself then? A better screen or something? A little bit faster chip? Is that what you're looking for to convince you to buy the iPad 2?
Well, a dual core chip would be very nice. You know, Apple has their own in-house A4 chip. If they can make a dual core version of that, that'd be pretty cool. But either way, even just a clock speed bump would be adequate, because I use my dad's iPad, and that thing blazes. It's fast.
Yeah.
It loads everything so quick. I mean, it's snappier than my iPhone, and of course they have the same processor in it, though the iPhone is likely underclocked a little bit to save battery time. What I'm looking for in the new iPad is a nicer resolution would be great. You're not gonna get what they call the Retina resolution, like on the
iPhone 4. Why not?
It's impossible. There's no display that has 321 pixels per inch
Okay.
Put that on a 9.7-inch screen. Not happening.
I'll take your word for it. If you say it's not feasible, I'm not a real hardware guy. I'm a bit
not for this year.
Not for this year.
It's impossible. It's like literally impossible.
But they could get pretty close to it. They could move. Well, the screen looks fine to me, but everyone's always looking for, you know, higher resolution.
Yeah. What's the iPhone 4 resolution? Is it it's like. It's 640 by 960 or something like that. I mean, if you're gonna, I don't know. I mean, that's a lot of pixels to work with. You're talking about a graphics processing unit on a mobile device. Even if they had the screen, it would probably be a pretty big resource hog to generate the image, wouldn't you think? With all those pixels and that kind of resolution.
Well, you're saying it sounds logical, but yeah. I'm sorry.
And in that case, you'd probably definitely need a dual core processor to work with if you're going to be dealing with applications that, you know, I mean, most people are still operating in that, like, you know, 1024 by 768, or if they're doing 16 by 9, 1280 by 720 or whatever. If you doubled the iPad's resolution, you'd be at like a higher than most desktops resolution. And I just would have to assume that'd be difficult for a mobile device right now to do.
I think, too, as more people move away from cable and being chained down to a certain device, iPads will become more popular for people to watch TV shows, movies, I guess read books, then surf the web. So much stuff is on the web now that, you know, it makes sense to have. And it's definitely a difference because I've used, you know, your dad's iPad, and the size, I think, makes a big difference. I'd love to get one for both my parents, you know. I think it's a great device for them, and I think the touch.
Yeah, my mom and my dad have really grown to love that thing. They, you know, when they go traveling now, they don't take a laptop unless my dad takes his laptop in case he gets phoned and has to do something for work on the road. But that's an old, you know, IBM laptop that he really wouldn't use unless he had to do stuff for work. But they just bring the iPad now, and they do whatever they need to do. You know, my mom likes it so much because it's just a bigger screen to work with.
Yeah.
And for people who have iPhone 4s, you're like, oh my God, iPad, you can see the pixels. What? Like, you know. But for most people who aren't spoiled by the resolution of an iPhone 4, the iPad is pretty great. And the one thing that I don't like is that the iPad 3G, which my dad has, it seems to be a little slow on 3G. Not really too slow. The download speed is great, but the upload for some reason gets capped at 30 kilobytes a second whenever I do speed tests. And I get, you know, in Chicago, I get 150 kilobytes a second up on my iPhone 4, which is presumably so they could at some point support FaceTime over 3G because you need better upload for that. But the iPad right now, it caps out at 30, just like my iPhone 3G did, and like my mom and my sister's iPhone 3GSs, they cap out at what I think is a pretty low upload speed.
Yeah.
And for someone who uses like the internet for everything, you know, it annoys me when you don't have good speed in both directions. So that's something I'm looking forward to maybe improving in the iPad 2 if I get a 3G version of it, would be to have similar speeds to the iPhone 4. Because otherwise, I would just buy a Wi-Fi version and tether it because I'm jailbroken and I can, you know, tether my internet connection from my phone to whatever I want. And unless they up the speeds on the iPads, I wouldn't even consider a 3G version. I'm just going to get the Wi-Fi.
Cool. Well, yeah, I mean, we'll have to see what I'm kind of excited to see what the new iPad looks like. And like I've seen I've seen dads too that I mean, like you have, and it's neat. It's really cool. Well, I was, you know, we kind of talked about Instagram, like, on a previous podcast and path.com. I was wondering, like, if you thought, you know, Jessica, like, or Jim, like, the is that really becoming an important new niche? It seems like there's a lot of buzz around, like, those sites where you share photos and it's all sort of in your iPhone.
I don't know. I kind of feel like it might be a fad.
Okay.
You know, I feel like the people that I've heard comments about, like, I knew you. I was a part of Instagram when I only had 400,000 fans or whatever.
Yeah.
It's kind of this age of, you know, Facebook is so big and so overpowering that it's hard for a lot of the little guys to struggle. So a lot of people are making noise about things. And I mean, I think photography is photography. And I don't know. I haven't found an app that is just like the ultimate one yet. And again, it's you know, you have to have people on there that want to like and look at your photos and comment on them. Otherwise, it's not fun. It's not fun to put up a photo and share it and have nobody comment on it.
Yeah,
you know,
I like Posterous because you can use it, you can easily upload, and then people can comment on the site. But you know, other people use a lot of different tools, and you can see how it's still evolving. There's a lot of companies imitating or doing something similar to Instagram. There's a lot of new games out that are similar to Angry Birds, and there's a lot of camera apps that are similar to Hipstamatic. And I'm not saying those are all the inventors of their genre, but you know what I mean. You can see the evolution happening very fast.
I will say though that I don't think one of the old school photo companies has really got a hold on mobile. I think we talked about this over Thanksgiving that Flickr's mobile app is horrible.
Yeah, Jim was talking about the bugs in their geolocation of tools there. That doesn't make any sense. That it geolocates your photo based on where you upload, not based on where you took it. Right? Is that right, Jim?
Well, yeah, you can take a photo with the app and it'll automatically, you know, upload it or whatever, and then it properly geotags it. But yeah, you can browse through your photo library and select a photo to upload after the fact. Like, you're not always going to take pictures in your Flickr app. So if you want to add something to Flickr, it then geolocates it from where you're uploading instead of just inheriting the geolocation from the JPEG file, because Apple puts it into it when you take the picture on the camera. So these pictures have geolocations already on them, but then Flickr, the app, just wants to geotag it. If you do geotag it, it only does it from where you upload it, which is ridiculous. It's beyond useless.
I think they missed the boat. I like Flickr.
I hate their app.
Yeah. So. Yeah, and there's no other big player has gotten in on the iOS market and really made you know, an impact the way that some of those new startups have, right?
Yeah, I mean, Instagram is cool. You know, it's a different kind of photography than Flickr even, you know, because you can only do so much with your iPhone camera. And I think that's kind of the idea behind it is, you know, look what cool stuff you can make with the filters and, you know, some interesting angles. And there's still some elements of photography there. You'll still see the artist shine through from the sort of clutter,
right,
but the
technology is very minimal. There's a certain amount of tweaks you can do, but you're using a small device and a simple program.
Right, and I guess this is maybe people just don't want to go and share it with everybody on Facebook because Facebook's kind of become overrun. So they're breaking off into smaller things again, into smaller networks. This is my photography network, and you know. But I think I've noticed people will join and then leave these groups a lot. You know, like. Where's the staying power? You know, what's going to make people stay?
Well, the network effect is what they're looking for. Like, that's why what Facebook has, right? There's so many other people on it.
It's key. It's really, really key, you know?
And then things like Instagram and Path, they're only on iPhone, too, which is a huge inhibition to growth. I mean, I know we're iPhone users, but there's so many people with Android handsets and stuff.
Yeah.
They really need to if they want to think about serious growth, they have to go multi-platform. But I think for these startups, they feel if you're going to do a startup, you might as well make it for iOS because you tend to make money easier or something. I don't know. And so that's one thing. Like, you know, one of my good friends, Mark, I was talking to him about Instagram, and I'm like, you should check that app out, just assuming that they had an Android app, you know, and because Instagram is pretty big these days, a lot of people are talking about it. Yeah. And then of course he looks on the Android market and there's no Instagram, and I'm like, well, geez, you know, like, that's one of the people I would like to share pictures with on a regular basis.
Yeah.
Which, you know, Instagram would make it easy to do. And they have a perfectly capable phone with a good camera in it, but no way of adding anything to Instagram. So that's kind of, you know, I checked Instagram out a couple weeks ago around Thanksgiving. I took a bunch of pictures. I thought it was pretty cool. And now I'm kind of like, it's kind of sitting, you know, it's an app on my phone that's just kind of sitting there waiting for the opportunity to present itself where it's actually like practical to start using it again. Because, you know, I'm just like, I don't like have any Instagram contacts hardly, you know,
right.
And it's just kind of, it's like a good idea that can't quite spring forward.
Right, and I mean, can it be like Twitter, where there are some really popular Instagram photographers that would be good to follow if you just want to get a cool feed of photos? Like, you know, maybe...
Yeah, but then Instagram also makes you do that square photo with, like, a couple preset effects, you know?
Yes.
They don't really let you go whatever way you want. So
right.
If you're going to be professional photographers on it, they're not going to... Obviously, they're not going to use those software effects. They're going to... do things more legit.
Well, yeah, and they could use a program like the GNU Image Manipulation Program for post-processing it, an excellent open-source app that I just want to mention is going to be in single window mode soon. All right. Sorry.
Well, I'm just wondering, like, why are so many people talking about Instagram when, I mean, it's all right, but it's not, like, mind-blowing, and it's not multi-platform. You know, like, it's just...
I think it's a good idea. But yeah.
Well, I had a whole list of other random stuff at the end, like, so I'm just going to throw this out there, like, scattershot, if anybody has anything they want to jump out with. Mac OS X App Store coming soon, Snow Leopard, and then OS X Lion. What are you thinking about that, Jim?
Well, I'm glad that... The worst predictions were not true about it. I'm glad that, you know, despite there being a Mac app store, you're going to be able to distribute apps like you always have,
right,
through normal channels.
Yeah,
that's
important.
And then, it'll be nice for the consumer to have a nice little curated, you know, set of applications that they can, and I think it's going to also... usher in an era of like micro applications. People are going to have like little apps on their computer, just like you do on your phone, to do very specific things. Mm-hmm. Like I have my Twitter app, and some of you have your Facebook app, you have your Instagram, you have your game. They all have very, like, you know, specific kind of functions. Like the mm-hmm. Twitter app doesn't also do Facebook, you know, and vice versa. And there are some apps that kind of feed that kind of thing into one, but still, for the most part, we're getting into an age where like all these little things have like very specific small purposes. So people are going to start buying the $3 or $4 or $1 Mac application that just adds a little widget for their feed here, or just this little program to do this one little thing. I think that the days of buying $300 software suites that do like a million different things are coming to an end, except for like high-end applications for professionals and stuff like that. I think that the consumer is going to start seeing a flood of smaller, cheaper, you know, programs that are a little less powerful, but, you know, are going to be good enough. So I think it's going to do stuff like that, but at the same time, I'm glad that it's not just like, if people were thinking that, you know, iOS was just going to become macOS.
Yeah, people were getting a little over their skis there. But
yeah,
but you were hearing that. I agree. And it's good that I agree with what you're saying. That's good that you can do it either way. And for a lot of people, it might be useful. It might serve as like a package manager. They can download stuff from it. They can get their updates through it. And, you know, for a lot of just everyday Mac users, it might be a really convenient thing. I don't know. The iOS 5's on the way. Hard to know what's going on with that. Solid-state memory computers. Is the new MacBook Air going to really push the solid-state kind of storage onto the computers in the mainstream? Is that going to be a trendsetter?
Well, I mean, I think solid-state in the mainstream is just a matter of time. When you look at the way it performs and lasts compared to conventional hard drives, there's really no comparison. It's just a matter of price per gigabyte at this point. And when it becomes friendly enough to the consumer, everyone's going to use it and not think twice about it.
And then, of course, there's going to be a flood of new Android products, some tablets, maybe some slightly better ones than the Samsung Galaxy Tab.
Yeah, probably 3 or 4 a week. Hard to keep track.
Yeah, and then Google Chrome OS, you know, they're going to try to push netbooks, revive the netbook market with pushing a Chrome OS. I can see you shaking your head.
I'm glad that they delayed that till the middle of 2011. I do feel like it's they're almost going to wait and see what happens in the next like 6 months.
With the Android tablet scene and stuff.
Those Chrome netbooks were supposed to be out a long time ago now.
Yeah, and there's been talk.
It keeps on getting pushed farther and farther back, and I think they're just going to, at a certain point, say, screw it, let's create, like, Android tablet OS.
Well, I think they should say, screw it. I think consumers, they're going to get Chrome netbooks, and hopefully they can say, just screw it, I'm going to put Ubuntu on there, because I don't really see much, you know, compelling about just a web interface when you can have a great operating system like Ubuntu that you can get right to the web through. And, you know, I mean, it just seems to make more sense to me. And I don't know. You know,
if you're going to do that kind of stuff, like what they're doing with the Chrome model does not belong on a netbook or a laptop. It belongs on a tablet.
Yeah, it's very locked down. Yeah, with just the web there. I mean, the web's great, but you do want to have options, I think. And, you know, desktop apps like the Open Office, you know, there's been a schism in the Open Office world, and there's LibreOffice. That's going to be coming out next year. I don't know. We'll see if that's any good. Hopefully that'll be better than Open Office, because that was really in a slump the last few years. You know, it's like, hopefully there's some new stuff on that. HTML5 and CSS3 on the web, are they going to explode this year? Maybe next year? Maybe? Hopefully?
I hope so. It'd be nice to see some better designs on the web.
Yeah, better. More and more HTML5 stuff, you know, good experience. Oracle is still, they're going to drag on that lawsuit over Java suing Google and everybody over that, right? That'll just drag on for years. There's nothing really much to that one. Novell got bought out. Now, that's very interesting because Novell has, you know, a lot of intellectual property patents and stuff. That intellectual property not being a word that I like to use, but that's what's thrown around, you know, patents and all these things are now being, their patent portfolio, like their assets are mostly being taken over by a company called Attachmate. But there's a shadowy company backed by Microsoft, basically, that's bought out Novell's patents. So a good time might be had by all, especially on the Mono platform and a lot of other stuff, where there could be an explosion of lawsuits from this Microsoft-backed group. So the Novell acquisition, that might be an interesting thing to blow up over the next year. So that's cool.
I was just going to throw in that I'm interested to see what HTML5 does for mobile applications in the next year. I know it's been something that's on the rise, but I don't know if you've heard of Sencha Touch. It's an HTML5 mobile JavaScript framework that allows you to like make web apps that would run, you know, like uniformly on Android or iOS just through the web browser and stuff. I think websites, you know, are going to have, especially ones that do e-commerce stuff, are going to have HTML5 based stores for optimized for mobile, because people are going to be shopping on their phones and their tablets so much in the future.
Right.
If you're not going to do a native app, and compile it in Java for Android or Objective-C and iOS, you're going to have to basically have a web application. And so I'm excited to see what HTML5 does for mobile more than desktop.
Well, I think I'm looking at Sencha Touch website right now, and this is actually really cool looking. I'm definitely going to be taking a look at the site after we're done because I had not really seen that.
Ran into that a couple weeks ago. I haven't done much with it, although I signed up for an account, I think, over there. But yeah, from what I understand, it's free to use even for commercial purposes. So that's pretty cool, and hopefully that, you know, it's just all part of HTML5's rise to prominence.
Yeah. Okay. And one more thing, I want to finish up on the web. We take a half a step back off the cutting edge and say what's going to be big on the web in terms of existing technologies this year. Is this going to be like a big year for PHP or? Ruby on Rails or like you hear a lot about Python too, and then are people just writing in C with frameworks and stuff? Any real? Is it all just going to be out there or nothing much? Everything's just going to kind of keep happening.
I was just going to say that, you know, I can't see like that many things happening to PHP in the next year. Of course, I could be wrong about that. I'm not really too tuned into, you know, the advancement of that. I know recently that I needed to downgrade from PHP 5.3 to 5.2 in order to get this Zend optimized PHP program to work on my server. Yeah. So I was kind of pissed off about that.
I think it's
more at Zend than PHP.
Everything requires I don't think it's moving that fast. I think we're getting to the point where almost everything seems to require PHP 5.1. But yeah, like you get up a few more points and you're up on the bleeding edge there. PHP 6 is a very long off thing. You know, who knows if that'll happen any time in the foreseeable future. I guess one thing though, stuff written in PHP does continue to advance. And you know, you and I both use WordPress somewhat on projects and consulting and stuff. And I've noticed that Drupal is really making a push with Drupal 7 for greater usability, you know, making it a little easier to set up for web events.
I was at a Borders today and I took a look at the computer books section. I noticed there were several books on Drupal and not one on WordPress. I'm sure there are WordPress books, but I thought that was interesting. I don't really have too much experience with Drupal, much more experience with WordPress. And I guess I'm going to have to check it out because it seems like it's pretty big. And plus, I was viewing the website for the Stanford iPhone application development course that they put on the web they've done it two winters in a row. They're probably going to start another one in January of 11. And I noticed their site, which is like, you know, they had some Apple guys teaching the class or whatever. That was powered by Drupal. And I was like, huh. So I'm starting to see Drupal more, you know?
I think Chuck Palahniuk and Bob Dylan both use it for their sites. And they have cool sites. On the other hand, a lot of people have cookie cutter Drupal sites. It's one of those things I think you have to really craft it and make it work for your site, and it can be really cool as an engine. But you know, it's not as easy to throw a site together with WordPress. At least, well, then again, of course, you know, I'm more familiar with WordPress. But that's cool. Well, I guess that was a great podcast. Thanks so much, Jessica, for joining us, and Jim, and you know.
Thanks for having me.
Cool. If Jessica's website, you can go to jessica.sf3am.com. She's writing really cool stuff there. And you can also, that site pulls in her tweets, so you can see what she's doing.
Yeah, that's right. I'm trying to tweet more. I like it.
At Jessica McKeown.
Yeah.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. I guess people should follow you on Twitter at JTMCK, right?
Yep.
Cool. All right.
I have a couple cool, compelling Twitter lists that I like to keep well curated. My most recent one is called Don't Be Evil and follows a bunch of Google feeds. So I think I'm up to 10 subscribers on my jailbreak Twitter list. So that's one thing I know you're trying to wrap up the show here.
No hurry.
One thing that's extremely underutilized in Twitter is lists.
Yeah.
Not many people use them. Most of the time when I check people is to see if they have lists, they don't have any. And I don't understand it. It's such a better way to take in a lot of information from Twitter without having to jam it all into your feed. You know, keep your really important stuff that you want to follow in your Twitter feed, the regular one, and then stuff that you want to check into casually, use a list. That's my Twitter recommendation of the year.
It's a good one.
Cool.
Make a list. Check it twice.
There's the train coming by. You can actually probably even hear that on the recording. Cool. Well, this has been the DJMblog.com podcast with me, Daniel J. McKeown, and my excellent co-host. So thanks for listening.
Bye.